This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
First step number one, unbutton the jeans.
Yes.
I've actually just done it now because I feel talking to you is an unbutton the jean type moment. You know, just the...
You know what, that's the nicest compliment you can give someone. It's like, talking to you is like unbuttoning my jeans after a long day. I'm like, yeah. Oh.
Hello, and welcome to The Body Protest.
In this podcast, we combine storytelling with science to better understand our relationship with our bodies. I'm Nadia Craddock, and I'm a body image researcher.
And I'm Honey Ross, and I'm a writer. This podcast is brought to you by The Pink Protest.
Two, three.
Hello,
hi,
body protesters.
We're back and we mean business.
And we're in
it.
The same room. This is the first time we've been in the same room doing this podcast together since 2019. Is that right?
I feel we did something February 2020. We recorded something at your house with Jamie.
Yes. The last episode we did in person in February 2020. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, because I'd just come back from Indonesia. I went to your house. We recorded that off the... And we've got a photo and I look so tired.
So tired. Jet-lagged.
But it's great.
And the fabulous Jamie Windust. Yeah, we could have chatted with Jamie for hours. We continued to chat for like an hour after with them.
Yeah.
What a great day that was.
That was a great day. I really enjoyed it. But yeah, that was our last like in-person podcast recording.
Yeah. And we then have... we moved to the medium of Zoom, which everybody loves so much.
It's just
good times all around.
Fantastic. We've seen each other a couple of times.
We have seen each other a couple of times.
Which has been glorious.
We've done some fun body protest work, which has been very exciting. And we've got more coming, which I think is even more exciting.
And we've got lots of fun things coming up as well. We're going to Cheltenham. Very fancy. I actually told someone at work and she thought I said I'm doing an event at Cheltenham and she thought I was a secret horse racer.
I love that. Jockey Nadia.
I know. I've been keeping that one quiet.
Yeah,
but
keeping that on the deal.
There's also the Literary Festival at Cheltenham. It's not just the races. So,
which is what we are there for. We're very excited to be joining the very exciting literary team. That sounds bizarre.
But yeah, we're going to do an event on October the 9th.
So please do come, if you're in the Cheltenham area, come check us out because we're going to be having big body image chats.
Yeah, big body image, body protest chats. It's going to be glorious.
It's going to be electric.
Oh God, I love it. But anyway, honey, tell me, how are you doing? How are things?
I'm good. I feel like I have regressed a little bit into a kind of... I feel like I've regressed slightly to my teenage anxious self. When we're not recording the podcast and I'm not doing stuff that feels more outward facing, like this is the most outward facing thing that I do is this podcast, and like I'm working on my writing at the moment, I become like a teenage version of myself, and like, yeah, I feel like I get quite shy now. It's really odd. Like, I think that is something the pandemic has done to me. I feel like a little teen, and I've like really regressed into like, I love my Switch. Like, I've been playing my Switch all the time. Like, I feel like
Nintendo
a
Switch,
boy.
Nintendo
Switch. I've been playing Zelda on my Nintendo Switch, and like completing every single shrine on it, and like watching Rick and Morty. I've become a teenage boy. Like, I really don't know what's happening to me, but I'm going with it. I'm going with the flow, and I'm enjoying myself.
Love that.
How have
you
been, my gorgeous?
Really well, thank you. I've been enjoying being out and about, being free, and then now seeing people where it's not a catch up.
Yes, it's
just
really nice.
Seeing people and just being out and having a good time. I'm just going to restaurants, eating good food, having good times. We're back. I do feel like back into myself. I feel like the pandemic for me was very, I mean, for most people, I feel, but like, I just felt very disconnected from myself.
Discombobulated.
At most points throughout, whereas now I'm like, oh yeah, this is it. But I have found that I have gone right back to completely overbooking myself.
Yeah.
Completely, you know?
All those conversations we had with ourselves about like the work boundaries and the life balance, it's like out the window. Yeah. That's so hard.
Almost always double booked. And also the planning, meticulous planning. I want to know what's happening 3 weeks in advance. I've gone right back there, but I kind of love that, you know.
It's nice being booked and busy in that way.
Yeah.
But it was also quite exhausting. I feel like there is so much that goes into just daily scheduling now, of like all of the kind of, it's not catch ups, but it's like fitting everyone in and it's making it work. It's like,
There is the logistic component of that for sure. But at the moment, because I'm still, the majority of the time, still working from home, I still have that nice, cozy bit.
That.
So then the balance for me is where I have the working from home and then it's the social fun times that need to be like scheduled and out and busy. I think if it comes to going back to the office 5 days a week, I think that's going to be a shock to the system for sure.
I hear that.
At the moment we're going in 1 day a week, which is amazing. It's like great to see people.
Yeah, that's a perfect
and fun, and we have our in-person meetings, and that's really nice. I much prefer meeting people in person than on Zoom. But it's tiring, you know, like it's a full day. No. I'm on a train at 7 a.m., you know.
Well, also, you're the only person I know who said they're like happy to get back into wearing jeans.
Oh, yes. And the fact that, like, we did have a conversation.
On a train, 7 a.m. in jeans, I'm like, you are superwoman.
But here's the thing about me and jeans. I used to be a full jean person. I used to, jeans were part of my uniform. All through my 20s, like, jeans were my uniform.
It's
I used to wear them all the time. And then I changed a couple of dress sizes. I outgrew my jeans. Mm. So all the jeans were then gifted or, like, passed re-owned. On. Yeah, found new homes. So that's all really nice. And then I just went to soft clothes. Flowing. But this is way before the pandemic. This was 2014.
You were in a kind of like a hippie floaty.
Yeah. And I
love that. That's
I just had that for a long time. And the thought of wearing jeans. And I feel like I had a block about going back to wearing jeans. You know, my body had changed and jeans were a bit of a block for me. But then after that full lockdown period of wearing like joggers the whole time,
24/7.
I was like, I need to feel like I'm in jeans. You know, I'm held up, I'm in position.
Yeah, it lifts you up into that position.
And I don't know what it is, but yeah. And, you know, I found the jeans that like suit my body type now. I feel comfortable
in
them.
What a feeling that is.
I'm really enjoying them. I bought 3 pairs of the same jeans.
A gorgeous mom jean. Let's shout out to the gorgeous mom jeans.
3 pairs, different colours. And now I'm done. I'm happy. I'm content.
I'm so glad.
I enjoy them. I like roll them up a little bit at the bottom. I feel very trendy.
You know, that's called the bisexual roll.
Yeah, well, you know, we're embracing it.
I love that.
Yeah, I'm liking it. And then I like when I get home, I can then unbutton the jean. It's the first stage. First step number one, unbutton the jean.
Yes.
I've actually just done it now because I feel talking to you is an unbutton the jean type moment, you know. Just the,
you know what, that's the nicest compliment you can give someone. It's like talking to you is like unbuttoning my jeans after a long day. I'm like,
So the top button is undone, and then I come home, the button is undone, and then the next step is like you put your home clothes on. So I have and this is pre-pandemic, I would have my work clothes, I would then have my home clothes, and then I have my pajamas. So there's that in between.
You know what? I call them softs. Yeah. I get home and I go out and put my softs on.
Yeah.
And it's like your little soft outfit. It's not quite pyjamas, but it's not quite day clothes.
Yeah.
It's your softs.
Yeah. Which we all lived in through the pandemic.
We lived in softs, yeah.
Right. So then, going back into some harder clothing. I've actually enjoyed. I quite like it.
It feels quite novel. Like when you put it on, you're like, okay, look at me wearing something with, you know, a seam and a little bit and a zip. Okay, zip.
I know, it's
different.
Like, I have a useful bag again.
Bags. Who knew, right? They are good fun.
Yeah. So, you know, that's where I'm at. But do you feel, I mean, obviously we're not out of the woods with the pandemic.
No.
But we've gone through our 3 lockdowns. Mm-hmm. Touch wood, we don't have another one. But do you feel you have had any reflections or thoughts on your relationship with your body and or food over the period.
I think it's been a really interesting journey. I think I almost found it easier when it was a bit more extreme in the pandemic. And I think, like, I did quite well. It was like I've been preparing my whole life for it. Whereas in the kind of, it felt a bit more abstract coming out. And I think, like, I've, as I said at the start, you know, I've definitely gotten more in my head. And that's one thing that's come from the pandemic is I think my relationship to my body has changed of, like, I don't know, maybe not having that feedback from friends of, like, having that kind of, like, reassurance ongoing. Not that I need constant reassurance and I, you know, I really know myself and love myself, you know, as I won't stop going on about. But, like, it's been interesting to hear old voices in my head and hear those kind of negative thought patterns that I've actively been having to step in and stop again for the first time in a long time. And, like, I think my relationship to social media changed completely. I really went from sharing quite a lot to sharing a lot less. I mean, still my, what I consider a lot less is still a lot for a lot of people, but, like,
is that sharing about yourself or sharing in general?
Sharing in general. I think, well, you know, it's a strange thing to talk about, but, like, I think my photos on Instagram started getting picked up a lot more by, like, trashy news outlets, like the Daily Mail.
Yeah.
Doesn't make it fun to post anymore. Like, it's like,
it does change the vibe, it doesn't it?
It's the vibe. I'm like, you know, I used to love posting photos of my ass. And it's like, you know what? It makes it less fun when I know it's going to end up in the tabloids. It's like, I don't want to share my ass with you, Steve. Like, that's not the vibe. No, I know, exactly. I wasn't ever doing it for Steve. So now I'm like, it takes the fun out of it. Like, I think, but to be honest, it's probably good. I think that's maybe growing up for me a bit of going like, you know what? Just because I can doesn't mean I should. And, like, I still love being a bit of an exhibitionist, but I think I need to renegotiate where and when that happens. And, like, that's just something I've been coming to terms with.
Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting, though, because I know from years of knowing you and how you are on social media, how much seeing you has meant for other people on social media. I know you've had a lot of, like, feedback from that. So, and I know that was part of why you did some of what you were doing. But then Steve has now got involved.
No, and it changes
and
it.
And it changes it.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I think it's complicated. I think it becomes complicated as soon as it's more people. Like, I think I always, I had a smaller following and then over the pandemic I got more people following me. And it's just like, it doesn't feel like the same intimate safe space I had. And, like, I think I have to be more careful with what I post. But, like, I'm trying to get past that. I want to be able to post, like, carefree again. But I just think Instagram now feels like a kind of cursed shopping channel.
Yeah, I mean, like, I feel that. And I think that's it. And, like, once you've watched, there was that Netflix documentary.
Was it The Social Issue? Yeah. Social Dilemma?
Social Dilemma. Yes. And, like, so once you've seen stuff like that, and you're just like, the reality of what social media really is, and it does change things for you, regardless of the size of your platform. It is about money. It is a capitalist venture.
You know?
That's what it is. And I think, yes, you can still have your safe corners of it that are cozy and nice, and it still has a purpose in terms of awareness and, I don't know, fun expression and things like that. But I think you do need to have back of mind what these platforms are really used for on a bigger scale. Thing.
I think when I was younger, my mission was always like, how can we blend like the most, how can I blend this social media platform with like being your most authentic self? Like my vision for a perfect world was everyone actually just being honest about how they felt about themselves and the world on social media. That I don't think is ever possible. One, because people don't want it to be, and two, I think because, like you said, it's a capitalistic venture, so I think it's not correct for that to be blended with authenticity, because those things don't go together.
Yes, and I think what's really interesting is that because of social media, businesses have changed
completely
in terms of how they represent people, because they have seen people in different bodies who look different, who have amassed huge followings, who have a lot of power and sway. And then suddenly we have seen a shift in how businesses choose to represent people and speak to people, communicate with people. And it's not just traditional models anymore. And when I say traditional models, I'm kind of thinking of those like very idolized stereotype models that we were so used to being fed in the noughties. But with the growing popularity of social media and the influence social media has and people on social media, I think it has shifted what brands do and who those models are. And those models aren't that stereotypical beauty standard anymore. We do see more diversity. And I think a big part of that, I don't think that it's the only part, but a big part of that is social media, because they can use the influencers are in, is a huge part of marketing now. It's a huge part of advertising.
Yeah, completely. Well, I actually think, I mean, I do really want to ask you about how you feel that the pandemic and this experience has changed your relationship to your body, but I think this leads quite nicely into the conversation we've been having about this. I coined the term fat fishing. I've told you this.
Tell me more.
So, and I actually think, and this is me being honest, I think I'm not part of the problem, but I have to be very aware of the fact that I'm capable of being part of this problem. And I think it's brands trying to win the praise and the accolades of being an inclusive brand, but they're hiring the smallest plus size person they can find, or in some occasions hiring a straight size model and padding her. That does happen. But trying to take the claim of being a fully inclusive brand, but actually ending up only going to a size 20, which is also not inclusive. Like, I can't remember, I think it was probably, you know, we talk about her every episode, Virgie, saying if you're not trying to go to a size 30, you're actually not an inclusive brand.
Also not the best at sizes, but I know, so in terms of, because I was thinking about what inclusive brands are in terms of sizing, or what's inclusive sizing, I feel like the best example that I have seen of it is Universal Standard. I think they do, and this is US sizing, but they do from 00 to 40.
Incredible.
And what I really like about that is that we're going, it's not just a catered for plus size, it is it's the whole spectrum.
It's everybody.
And then they have amazing things on their website, from you see different size models, so you see the fit, what it's going to look like on your body. You've got that huge range of sizing, and I think that they're kind of leading the way in that. But then if we think of inclusive sizing in the UK, I think places like ASOS will probably go up to a 24.
But ASOS is actually pretty good. I will say, like, ASOS is one of the places I've shopped consistently my whole life. I know that's not great because of fast fashion, but I'm fat, where would you have me shop? Like, genuinely message me and I will change my ways. But they go up to a 30 in a lot of areas, especially in their own brands. I think it's when they're stocking other people's stuff they don't. But it's harder. And I think, you know what, it's a complicated issue as well with, that's a whole other conversation of, like, plus size clothing and fast fashion. Because it's like, I've had people be like, it's awful that you've got this dress from XYZ. And I'll go, one, everything I get, I keep for 10 years. I've got outfits that I've still had from when I was 14. Like, I genuinely don't throw anything away, because as a plus size person, you just don't. You keep things forever and you keep them in great condition. But it's that thing of, like, most places that do a really good size range cost a fucking fortune. It's really, like, ethical plus size clothing is so overpriced, or not overpriced, it's probably actually what most clothes should cost, and, like, to be knowing that everyone is getting paid at every level of the process. But it's like, you know, I love this brand called Fashion Brand Company. They go up to a size 30, they're incredible, so expensive, ridiculously expensive. And it's like, that's the kind of thing you'd buy one piece a year and keep it for absolutely ever. But that's not practical if you're needing to have a wardrobe and turn up to things and you want to look nice. Everybody wants to look nice, and that's valid and okay.
Yeah, that's completely it. I keep thinking of Elaine Fisher, which again is, I think, pretty inclusive for sizing, ethical brand, but it is not cheap.
No.
It is. I think there's so many different layers to this conversation in terms of what does it mean to be an inclusive fashion brand? Because yes, we can talk about size inclusivity. And it's interesting that we mentioned Jamie at the top of the show, because I really remember Jamie talking about gender inclusive clothing. So actually scrapping the binary from women's clothes, men's clothes, and just having clothes, have a clothes section. Something that I had not really thought about in a meaningful way before that conversation with them. Apart from maybe with children's clothing, you know, when you have pink clothes and, like, blue clothes.
Really, I think I
thought about it in that way, and making me think about what I used to wear as a kid. My, like, secondhand yellow dungarees were a classic.
Yeah, I quite, also something we'd both wear now.
Yeah, well, that's it. I used to get teased for, like, having, like, not cool clothing. And I was like, actually, I look back at pictures of myself, I was like
I was dressed
ahead of my time. I know, ahead of my time. But I think, but in terms of, like, layers to this conversation, we've got gender inclusive clothing, we've also got clothing for people with different abilities.
Yeah.
And so I was have been in some really interesting conversations with people who are talking about how do you, because you have to know how to design for different types of bodies, right? So, and this also applies to different size bodies, but if you have different ability bodies, so if you live in a, if you're a wheelchair user, for example, I remember someone saying about, you need to have clothes that are comfortable to be in a sitting position.
Yeah.
And not all clothes are. Like my jeans, for example. Exactly. And so I thought that was a really interesting layer that I really don't have much knowledge on at all. Again, I think that all comes back to then the privileges, my body and habits in terms of being like straight size, able-bodied, etc. But it's all very interesting. And then kind of thinking then from that brand perspective, it's complicated. It's not easy. It's no. Like, this is not easy. And I think one of the things I think about a lot when we're talking about this whole conversation about inclusive brands is the minute you have that label inclusive, it opens you up for criticism, which is not something I want to quash. But no. Also, I think we need to be mindful and cognizant of the brands who are not doing anything.
Completely.
And they kind of get away with murder because they're not claiming to be anything, so therefore they don't get any criticism.
Well, this is the thing of like Brandy Melville. Like, I think, like, not to shit on a brand, I'm like, I don't want to get sued, I don't know what that legality of that is, but, like, they have been one-size-fits-all forever, and I think there's, like, really problematic stuff happening behind the scenes. No one's calling Brandy out, but it's, like, because they're not trying to be inclusive, so they kind of slip under the radar, whereas the minute a brand puts themselves out there in that way, it opens them up to a world of accountability, which is also a good thing, but it makes it complicated. It's like you said, people aren't holding other brands accountable if they're not even making that claim, and that's where we need to kind of change on that level.
Yeah, and it, for me, it really mirrors some of those conversations that we have with, like, the word feminist, right? Yes. Like, feminist brands. Have you heard of femvertising?
No, I haven't. Please elaborate.
So it's this whole, I think it's just, like, an academic term for female empowerment through advertising. So it's your whole girl boss, girls can do everything.
This girl can.
And a way.
It's lovely. Like, yeah. I feel, because it's like.
Well, that's it, because it's not terrible. It's not terrible, but I think then you have to look what's behind the curtain with
it's
some
nuanced,
of things.
Yeah.
So people can turn this like woke washing. There's parallels with greenwashing, completely. For example, with.
What
with,
was it? H&M being like, we're helping guys. And it's like, are you?
But it's hard because sometimes you agree with the message and that's part of the purpose of it, like, it's all about social purpose, and sometimes you agree with the message, but then you then are then looking for consistency throughout everything that brand does. So if they're doing that femvertising, if they're talking about female empowerment through their ad campaigns, is there female empowerment embedded within their infrastructure of the company?
Like, you know, on every level, are they actually backing the message that they're putting forward?
Yeah, so and in many ways that's a good thing, because it does make you, as consumers now, we do have all of that information at our fingertips, so we can look, and then you can push brands to be more accountable and be better. So I don't think it's a bad thing at all, but it is interesting when you then have other companies who don't have any kind of claim and don't and kind of get away with everything. And with there's this piece, have you read Otega Uwagboo's new book, Let's Talk About Money?
No, I haven't, but I love Otega.
Amazing. I'm so sad she's finished it. She had a podcast called In Good Company, and it was one of my favorites.
You were telling me about it. So good.
Such a good interviewer. And but yeah, she's wrapped that up now, but I do love it. So in her book, in Let's Talk About Money, she talks about the wing, and obviously there are huge, so much you can go into with that, but she looks at it in terms of, yes, problematic, but there are a number of other, like, private working spaces or members clubs that didn't come under the same scrutiny because they don't advertise themselves as a feminist or any kind of social purpose type company or organization. So of course then the minute there is that label, you are going to interrogate it more. And I think we've gone a little off topic, but I think
no, but it's true though. I think it's like, I mean, to be honest, it's what's happening in general with, like, us on the left, isn't it, of like, we hold ourselves to a higher standard when actually in general we're more unified and we could be directing our attention to people who aren't even on the same side as us.
Yeah, and actually there's a black feminist writer called Loretta J. Ross, who talks about calling out, calling in the most beautifully articulate way. I think
I love that term as well, calling out, calling in is brilliant.
Well, I think some of the work that she's done is really about calling in. She does, she compares and contrasts the two, but really advocates for more calling in as opposed to just calling out. We can link in the show notes, but it's really powerful, a really powerful way of communicating, and really is about that message of actually you have more in common, and let's look at the common themes and how we can connect, rather than kind of trying to work out different ways of putting each other down to be like, I'm the most enlightened, the most woke, the most, and therefore, you know, you're wrong. Because yes, in certain issues, you might know something about something, but are you hitting all those domains? And actually, let's see how we pull each other up so everyone is moving towards a common goal more than
completely.
Just, and she articulates it in wonderful ways. There's some good podcasts she's on as well, really talking it through. She's got a course. I think there's a book coming out, if it's not out already, but how to agitate for change in a way that actually realises that change happening rather than just saying, you're terrible, well, because you're not doing enough. So I think bringing us back to our inclusive fashion brands, and I think this relates all to cancel culture and stuff. Completely. Should we just cancel all these brands because they've gone up to a size 20 and they've not gone further, but actually it's going to a size 20 better than the average?
Not even trying at all. It's a step to a size 20 is a step in the right direction. So I guess it's worth celebrating that achievement. But then it's complicated, isn't it?
Yeah, it's complicated. And I also, again, say this as someone who's straight size. So I don't have an issue of finding anything that fits me when I go into a shop. So I also want to put that out there in terms of having this conversation. It's much easier for me to be like, this is wonderful, because it's more inclusive where but I think it's one of those things where it should be something that does affect me, and I should want to shop in somewhere that does have clothes that fit my friends of different sizes.
Well, that's something I've even been trying to face of, like, as a plus size woman, I benefit from being on the smaller end of plus size, and I can shop at the places that only go up to a 20. I fluctuate between 16 and 20, like I always have. And it's like, I still want to support those places, but it's actually like, is it now about directing my focus to sporting places that are all inclusive? But it's like all of the things we've already discussed. It's money. It's, you know, it's the nuance of all of these situations.
Well, it does come back to money. So I think as consumers, if we say, no, we actually do want you to go up to these sizes, leaving money at the table if those brands are not extending their size range.
That's but the I language think, they understand as
yes,
well.
Yes, though I think there is a difference, and speaking to a lot of people within fashion, I think there is that difference, particularly when you have like your haute couture and like your very high-end fashion, which want to be completely exclusive. So they have like no interest in expanding. They're like, no, this is what we do and how we do it, and that's it. I think there is an easier opening in like high street fashion because they do
It's a paying market,
yes,
and people just want, it's a business, and
you
know, as much as the fact is, like, businesses don't actually care. I think we have to remember that it's like a business is a business. I'm sure there are people within the business who do care.
Yeah, so I think
But a brand is not physically capable of caring because it is a brand.
Whereas, I think, as you say, that there are people within brands who do really care, but because
I completely
there are
agree.
People all
We've
wearing
met
clothes,
them.
Right?
We like, know yes, them. Yes,
yes. There are people all wearing clothes, and I think what's interesting, again, speaking to a lot of people in fashion about some of these issues, is you need the right people in the brand, and I think this 100%. Comes back to lots of different things with conversations about TV and film and lots of different industries. But within fashion, you need designers who know how to cater to larger size bodies. So then that also goes back to when you're in design school or fashion school or whatever. Are you having instruction about how to design clothes for different size bodies or different bodies? Or are they just working to that one single mold, which actually is, I think, the norm. You're working to one mold. You kind of learn about proportions that are not realistic proportions.
Yeah, you learn about proportions and then scale them up from like a very small size. Whereas actually there are brands like Snag Tights and Loud Bodies that have now been working on expanding and like I think have actually pushed forward that kind of process of it's not just scaled up from a thin person's measurements. It's actually like I think Snag Tights they base their measurements all off of like a size 20 and scaled down, like for everybody. It's really different. It's a completely different process. And Loud Bodies do the same thing.
Yeah, I think that's it. And I remember speaking to a pattern cutter, and they said
it's completely different.
Whereas you can't just scale up, you need different patterns to work with different bodies. And I think that does involve extra layers for that business. But
for sure. Well, no, and I think the problem is, as well, is when you expand your range, you're using more fabric. That's always the argument, isn't it? It's like with plus size clothes, you're using more fabric, and so they have to charge more. Or a company like Loud Bodies
ups the price of absolutely everything to make it fair.
Uh-huh.
Like, yeah. But it's, you know, and that, I guess, is one of the ways of making it doable, but it's still, like, again, an expensive brand. And I've seen, Loud Bodies is actually one of those brands where I'm like, oh, no, you really care. It seems to be run by this very passionate person who was, like, just trying to fight the good fight from the inside, and they're, like, constantly posting stories about, I mean, they posted these stories about how they had gone to a pattern cutter and been like, we want to go up to a size, like, 30, we want to go up to a size 40. They were trying to expand to a 40, and the pattern cutter had been, like, really fatphobic and had been like, no, this is disgusting, like, I can't make it work, I can't do it. And they had been just devastated and really sad about it. And but they've now made it work and found a way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But now they're taking on this incredible battle of trying to make affordable plus size really inclusive clothing. Mm-hmm. And seeing if that's doable, and like seeing this process of this woman documenting, like, scaling back patterns, making things more simple. Mm-hmm. So it can be more affordable. But it's like, there are so many sacrifices, especially with small businesses, of trying to become an inclusive brand.
Right. Thinking back to Virgin, what you're saying, where that brand, and I can't remember what the brand was, but making that choice of, like, actually, because they were a smaller business, perhaps that they went bigger rather than, and actually lost some of their smaller sizes. Mm-hmm. Because they were like, this smaller size range has been catered to already. Let's expand this way. So that's a decision that someone's making, right? So I think that's really interesting. I think we definitely need to speak to someone who's working in fashion to really take us through all of these different
steps. For sure.
I think it's super interesting and important, and it's like understanding all these different layers and nuances. And I think it's perhaps too simplistic to say that the fashion industry is fatphobic. I think it is, but I think society is. But also fashion does lead the way. I think in terms of culture, I think fashion has huge sway and influence. So if we can have, and I remember seeing, and I don't know who to credit for this, but I remember seeing, because I think so much of fashion is about trends, and I think we had this huge trend of having more inclusive fashion, and now that's kind of gone. We had this like peak, and then we've moved on. And so it's kind of always keeping that pressure there.
Yeah, well, especially with like the early 2000s coming back in fashion, and I think that's been a source of anxiety for a lot of people. Especially, like, you know, we've seen the memes about low-rise jeans. Right. Like, we've not been living under a rock. But like, and I love early 2000s fashion, but I'm also quite fearless in how I dress, and I understand that, like, tracksuits coming. Okay, this is something I've been thinking a lot about, actually, of as a fat woman, the level of performance you have to do to look, air quotes, put together is so much more. And I think, you know, you'll see a photo of like Bella Hadid wearing like, I was gonna say a burlap sack and I was like, that's really mean, but like wearing like something very casual, just you know, a pair of tracksuits and a white t-shirt and a pair of jeans, and they're like effortless, stylish, a star. If someone saw me wearing that, they'd be like, is she okay, is she all right? Not necessarily I think I'm trying to change that attitude, but like I think that has always been my perception of like, well, I think that was what scared me about even growing up in the early 2000s, of when I put on a tracksuit, it looked like I'd really like had a bad day rather than looking like Paris Hilton.
I completely hear that. And I think then you've got a really interesting intersection with race, because I really remember a conversation, and I must have been about 15, but I was at a dance event and someone said, and she, this woman was a little bit older, but she was like, The Danes always look so elegant. And basically, if you're, because I mean, I was very thin, but like it was, there was something also about being like blonde and tall. Yeah,
thin, white and blonde. It's like you're always put together and effortless and chic.
Yeah, will always look good. They will always look good. And it was very interesting.
And you're like, oh, that's interesting. Like, oh. It's like, do they look good or are they just thin, white and blonde?
Yeah, well, yes, I think that's
an internalized perception.
There's all of those memes of like, do they look good? Is that
or are
a
they
fit?
Just thin? Yeah.
Is that a fit or is that person just thin?
Are they serving face or are they just thin?
Yeah, Mikey Mercedes.
Yeah.
credit there. Is that
credit where credit's due.
Always something to reflect on.
It's always something to think about. Let's come back to the original question that I would love to hear. How has the pandemic affected your relationship with your body? Have you had thoughts, musings on it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think the jeans were the big moment for me.
We love the jeans.
We've just discussed that. I don't think it's changed my relationship with my body so much, because I feel like, because I feel like my relationship with my body has been quite consistent of recent years, and partly probably because my body stayed very, very what's the same over recent years. So I think that's probably a big piece to it. I think with food has been interesting. Obviously, I have had a very complicated relationship with food over the years. And I think it's been interesting for me to see how I reacted at different stages of the pandemic. So I think at the beginning, I was like most people, was very anxious. When I'm very anxious, find it very difficult to eat. So that was a thing at the beginning. And then that in itself freaked me out because I was like, I'm going kind of almost inadvertently going into old patterns, not intentionally, but just out of anxiety. And actually what I've noticed about myself with food is that when I'm in any kind of heightened state, and that can be anxiety for sure, but then it also could be if I'm nervous or if I'm very excited. So if I'm like very excited, food is like, I find very, it's not, I find it difficult to eat, but then I'm not interested
you're not
in
even
it
thinking
in the same,
about it.
Yeah,
no,
it's
I understand
not, but I mean, I think that's very primitive, right?
Because I think if you're that's in normal. Like, if you're I think it's any heightened state, you're like, oh, and no, I can't even think
in,
about that right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, well, if you're in that flight or fight mode, you're like, the last thing you're looking to do is, I'm going to eat a balanced meal.
Yeah, exactly.
With a knife and fork.
Yeah, you know, like, it's like not, our lizard brain being like, run, mama. Like, it's like, it's not time to sit down and eat a snack. Like,
but that's it. But I really noticed that about myself, but then got a bit freaked out at the beginning because then I was like, I really am not eating okay, and I was like, I can't. Yeah. We're not going. Like, I have nightmares about having relapse, and I was just like, that is not what we're cool. Like, we're definitely not doing that. And then went to a very like methodical 3 meals, 2 snacks in a very like programmatic way. But I needed it, and I was like, actually very proud that I did that for myself. I was like, you know what, we were here. Then kind of, I think as things were dragging out, got into like a very like comfort eating stage, which, you know, no judgment towards, but it just was, I think there is something about that where it can feel physically and emotionally uncomfortable.
Yeah, well, also I think the first day of a comfort eating phase is always amazing, and like, I'm really doing this to nourish my soul, and then like a week into it you're like, okay.
Yeah, well, you just don't feel good, and that was kind of interesting for me, and how to kind of move through that without like judgment.
Yeah, move through it compassionately with yourself.
And but what's been interesting then, as soon as things have like kind of, I've got back into it, more of a routine, and because I was living on my own as well, I think that was a big piece of it, because then you're like, I just don't even know what's, and also someone who has had such a disordered relationship with food, it's very hard for me sometimes to know like what is normal eating. I don't know.
And there's something about the removal of the feedback of having eating meals with people regularly. I think it made it even harder to think of what's a balanced meal, what's normal to eat, what's, am I eating at a normal time? And I also think it's interesting you talking about implementing the 3 meals a day of like, especially because we've talked so much about intuitive eating. Mm-hmm. It was important to enforce that of like, we need to eat regimentedly throughout the day, but it's like, it's hard to then break out of that and go back to intuitive eating. And like, I've been finding like, I was like, I felt disconnected from my body because I'd implemented 3 meals a day, which is something that I had stopped doing. Because I was like, that was just a number made up by someone. Who needs 3 meals a day?
Well, I think that's it. And it is really interesting because I have really struggled with intuitive eating. I'm fully on board with the concept, but like, it's fully about trust as well. And I think for me, being relatively regimented, but also with an element of flexibility.
Yeah.
It's like anyone in sort of recovery, the big thing is to be flexible. And I think there was something about, although I was eating my 3 meals a day and my snacks and whatever, and it was great, but very samey.
Yeah.
So then when you're coming out of it and you're like, oh, there are other foods. And as that time has gone on, it's been like enjoyable again. Yeah. Being like, oh yeah, no, this is fun, and I'm like enjoying like eating out and eating at other people's houses.
And when you can find joy in food again.
Yes. Whereas I think the joy came out quite a lot for me with the pandemic, because it was a lot of eating on my own. That's where I was really getting in my head. Not really with my body, but getting in my head with food, and then also because I, you know, was trying to still like keep on top of work and everything, and it was like, that was all a bit weird, but you know, we've moved through it.
I think it's that thing of all the joy was sapped out of like cooking, like any meditative fun, or like the fun you might have had like prepping an exciting meal. It was like after day 200 you're like, it's not fun anymore. Like, and it's like, it's hard to find that release in it, and it's like, it's nice to be having that like to be able to go to restaurants again, to be able to experience, like, go to a friend's house and have them cook for you, even.
Yes.
Just
yes.
to have that have variety.
That, have that, have birthday cake with someone.
Yeah, oh, my
it was
God.
Like, yeah. That was just, like, such a treat, because I think, again, it wasn't that I wasn't eating any of these foods through the pandemic, no. but, like, you know, there are definitely fun foods involved,
but it's not
when
the same.
There's no, when there's not, like, the social component, it loses its edge.
Yeah, well, I became really obsessed with this. I think I maybe told you this, but I became really obsessed with this very specific Korean, like, noodle dish called tteokbokki, uh-huh. which is like it got like a kind of big gelatinous like rice thing in it. It's really good, but like I think I saw someone make it on TikTok and was like, I need to learn how to make this, yeah. and then started making it, and I made it all the fucking time, and by the end of a couple of weeks I was just so sick of it, and it was like, it was a fun food, like it could yeah. not have been more fun. It was bright red, it was full of gochujang, it was delicious. But by the end of it, I was like, I'm sick of my cooking. I can't have it again. I'm like, take this delicious, exciting meal away from me. I can't do it. But it's like, I think that's just, you know, that was just the time.
It was. It really was. But I actually would really like to try it. So when you're ready to go back into that cycle.
I am ready. I think I'm getting there. Honestly, my poor housemate, my childhood best friend, Lulu, was always like, honey, like, not again. And she was like, and it gave me like a really upset stomach. It was like, quite like, it was a weird cycle, guys. It was weird. It was a weird time. Wait, before we move on, we have to share the most amazing thing we made when we went on holiday together.
The crumble.
Oh my goodness, that's like weird. I feel like we made some like good things.
We made so many good meals. We went on a body protest holiday and Nadia suggested the most inspired thing. We truly lived our best cottagecore fantasy and were like foraging for berries in the woods. But tell.
But it was a perfect time because the blackberries, what I'm really struggling with blackberries is that they are no longer late September. Mm. They are August. It's they so are weird. An August fruit.
Yeah.
So it was August. And yes. they were ripe for the picking. They were so abundant. We picked masses. I mean, yeah. I think we were both having a bit of a purplish tinge by the end. yeah. But we made a blackberry and pear, because there were some pear trees. So we got some pears, blackberry and pear crumble, and it was delicious. And in the crumble, we had ginger nuts.
It was the Game best changer. Thing. Yeah, Game ginger changer. Biscuits, mashed up ginger biscuits
mixed into the crumble. And it was like, and then Nadia picked edge. Like a stunning vanilla ice cream.
Oh yeah, it has to be. So vanilla ice cream is my absolute number one fave, which...
Nothing wrong with doing vanilla.
I won't hear anything about it.
No.
Love it. Won't hear anything about it.
There's
I
nothing
love
wrong
it.
With it.
I really like it. It has to be a high quality vanilla, don't get me wrong. Mm. You're not a basic vanilla.
Like, it has to be a proper...
It has to be, you know, I want to see a little bit of a pod action.
Yeah, give me a vanilla pod and I'm there every day.
I'm really happy.
Oh, God. I think I got really into a pistachio ice cream. I love a bit of a pistachio
and a pistachio gelato. And actually a friend, an Italian friend, said when you're trying out a new gelato place for the first time, you have to try the pistachio first, and then you know whether the place is good or not.
True words are never spoken.
Catty for teaching me that, because that's what I do every time now.
Okay, that's good to know. When you're trying out your new gelato spot, don't forget to get a scoop of that pistachio so you can review brutally.
Yes. Well, yeah, you know whether you want to go back.
You know if it's worth going to.
Okay. And with that, I think what a glorious
catch-up. I know. It feels weird saying catch-up because we're not catching up anymore.
No,
this is
fun. We have an amazing season coming up, but it's going to be ready when it's ready because we are busy ladies.
Yeah, busy ladies who want to make it... Well, we care about this show so much and we just want to make it the best it can be. And that takes time. Hard work takes time and we're putting the work in because we care about you. It sounded so insincere, but insincere, because it's very sincere.
I love it. It is sincere from the bottoms of our hearts, but also we just don't want to rush.
We don't want to rush.
So it's coming.
It's going to be juicy. It's going to be fantastic.
It's coming. And if you want us a little bit earlier, come to Cheltenham.
Come to Cheltenham and visit us and say hello. But yeah, you're going to laugh, you're going to cry, and you're going to think.
And with that, thank you for listening to The Body Protest.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Body Protest.
We really hope you've enjoyed this episode, and it would mean the world to us if you could subscribe, rate and review.
You can follow Honey on Instagram at HoneyKinney.
And you can follow Nadia at Nadia.Craddock.
This podcast is produced and edited by the glorious Daisy Grant.
And it's brought to you by the Pink Protest Podcast Network.